German soldier to his officer, where is Guillemont? I can't see it. Officer, hold on, I'll point it out to you. Look at the shell impact and the black earth rising. That is an open field. Now see that impact followed by red dust rising. That is Guillemont. There you are. When morning paled, the strange surroundings gradually revealed themselves to our disbelieving eyes. The defile proved to be a little more than a series of enormous craters full of pieces of uniform, weapons and dead bodies. The country around, so far as the eye could see, had been completely ploughed by heavy shells. Not a single blade of grass showed itself. The churned up field was gruesome. The village of Guillemont seemed to have disappeared without trace. Just a whitish stain on a cratered field indicated where one of the limestone houses had been pulverised. And those words were written in his famous book, Storm of Steel, by the German officer, Ernst Junger. And he's so well known in Guillemont that today there's a road named after him. So welcome to another edition of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And this week, the 3rd of September, will mark the 107th anniversary of the final capture of one of the great killing fields of the Somme battlefield, the village of Guillemont. The first attempt to take this formidable defensive position on the south of the Somme battlefield had occurred during July, and several attempts by many battalions and regiments had failed in that field of grass, or what started off as grass, between Trones Wood and those sunken roads, the ruins of Guillemont, the quarry and the station just to the north of the village. Whenever I go to the Somme, our story usually takes us to Guillemont and the surrounding areas. But when we're there, we don't often see many people. We certainly don't see coach parties. No one seems to go there unless they've got a reason to do so. So I thought that I would try and encourage people to go to Guillemont. There were so many stories to discover in that area. The Guillemont Road Cemetery itself contains so many notable graves, including the grave of Raymond Asquith, who was the son of the then Prime Minister. So this week, what I thought I would do was tell the story of Guillemont, as usual, not through the history books, but through the stories of the British and the German and the Irish soldiers that were there in August and September of 1916. Through the early weeks of July, as we know, the BEF had fought their way from their original positions on the 1st of July through the woods and the villages of the Somme battlefield. The losses were, of course, enormous on both sides. The tactically important village of Guillemont had been attacked, as I said earlier, several times and had actually been entered three times, but it was never secured. Those powerful German counterattacks always ended up forcing them out at great cost to everybody. And so at the end of August, it was still in German hands. But of course, the German defenders had also lost heavily. Their reserves were limited. The British knew that, and they calculated that one last push would win the battle for the village and then threaten Combles and secure a line for which they could assault a third German position, which was barring the road to Fleurs. And taking Guillemont was obviously no easy task. Guillemont and the nearby village of Ginchy had been typical rural Picardy villages. But by the end of August, early September, both these villages had ceased to exist because they'd been bombarded by the British so often. And as the German soldier said, you can only discern them, you can only discover them by flat heaps of rubble and reddish dust. All around, the wasted landscape was shell-torn and desolate. So during this podcast, we're going to feature mainly on that day, the 3rd of September 1916, when Guillemont finally fell to the British and the Irish soldiers. But I'm going to go back a few weeks before that. I said that Guillemont had been entered briefly three times in the previous few weeks, and one of those dates was the 18th of August. And I wanted to focus on that date because men from my hometown of Northampton were involved in that battle that day through the 7th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment. And they were being led by that famous man that we talked about in a previous podcast, Edgar Mobbs. He was wounded that day. So on that day, the 18th of August, the weather was dull and damp, and as day broke, the German positions in Guillemont had sustained almost 24 hours of steady bombardment. And throughout the morning, the artillery fire continued until 0 hour, which was at 2:45 p.m. in the middle of the afternoon. As the final minutes ticked away, the rate of fire never altered, and they hoped that this would prevent the Germans anticipating the attack. And then, as the whistles for 0 hour blew, the field artillery brought their fire back into no man's land. This is the creeping barrage they're using. And this barrage was landing no more than 100 yards in front of the attacking soldiers. And as the men approached towards this curtain of fire, the field artillery then began to lift forward in increments at the rate of 50 yards per minute. This is typical of the new invention, the creeping barrage. The idea of this would, it would give the enemy no time to lift their heads and prepare their guns. The British soldiers may, of course, get too close to this creeping barrage and pick up casualties, but the casualties would be far less than using the previously used fixed bombardment. And by this time in the battle, the soldiers jumping off trenches were halfway across that field between Trones Wood and Gullimont, and in fact they ran just across the field as you look north towards Delville Wood from the actual cemetery, the Gullimont Road Cemetery that's there now. Now, our men from Northamptonshire, they managed to gain a foothold in the German lines that were adjacent to the quarry that's still there. And this was an extraordinary achievement on the part of these men. And later on, they were reinforced by a company of men from the 9th Battalion of the Royal Sussex. And as darkness fell that day, engineers were brought forward to help in the process of consolidation on what was the western outskirts of the village. Now, I mentioned a few minutes ago about the creeping barrage. I'm sorry to say that some of those shells did indeed land on the lip of the Northamptonshire's own trenches, and it was during the early hours of the attack that Edgar Mobbs was hit by shrapnel. Perhaps he was hit by friendly fire. Edgar was hit in the ribs by a flat piece of shrapnel. He was lucky it wasn't one of those jagged edges. He was obviously in agony, he was badly bruised and winded, but he insisted on carrying on. Such was the attitude of this incredible man, but his task was impossible. He could hardly walk. He was taken to a base hospital, and it meant that he had to leave his loved battalion, his men of Northampton, behind. But into attack the North Ants did go, and there was a man called Percy Slark. He was a sergeant, and he later said that the machine gun bullets coming from the Germans was like a bee-like noise, and hundreds of particles of shrapnel and bits of bullet hit his face and blinded him. He did recover his sight, but he said that even 50 years later, he would find particles of shrapnel on his pillow, tiny pieces of shell that had left his flesh during the night. The North Ants war diary confirms that although they had partial success, their casualties were enormous. 5 officers and 45 other ranks killed, 15 officers and 250 other ranks wounded, 1 officer and 49 other ranks missing. Back home in Northampton, the Independent newspaper reported upon the gallant achievements of the local men. It says that Colonel Mobbs was wounded and the battalion succeeded in taking a most important position held by the enemy and retained it most gallantly in the face of a very severe bombardment. The brave tenacity with which the 7th held on against a positive inferno of shot and shell forms one of the most thrilling and heroic episodes of the war. The splendid stand of the 7th soon became known along the line, and when they returned to camp on relief, they were greeted with rousing cheers. It was eventually established that 47 men of the battalion died that day. Only 3 of them have known grave, the others being remembered on the Tietvale Memorial. So no doubt many of those other men are still lying there in those fields where they fell. One of those men that died that day from Northampton was a Sergeant Albert Allibone, and he'd been awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal just a few weeks before when he'd saved a comrade. He dug him out after being buried by a shell, but unfortunately that was the fate that ended his life at Gullimont. The local newspaper said that Sergeant Allibone from 85 Row Road in Northampton was, according to a comrade, buried by a shell and has not been seen since. It is thought that he might have been taken prisoner as his company fell back just afterwards. He was the first of the company raised by Edgar Mobbs to gain the DCM. He was very popular in local athletic circles. But as we know, he wasn't taken prisoner of war, buried by that shell, and perhaps he's still buried, perhaps he's still on that battlefield. and perhaps one day his body may be found. Serving alongside Allibone that day was a man called Frank Heap from Abington Grove in Northampton. On the 1st of September in the Chronicle and Echo, it was reported that the family hadn't heard from him for a fortnight, and from what has been said in letters from his comrades, the parents are becoming anxious. He worked in the Union Bank and Thrapston and joined the army when war broke out. And then a few weeks later, it says that one of the four sons of Councillor Heap, serving with the forces, is unofficially reported missing. He was last seen on August the 18th, and since when several of his comrades state that all trace of him has been lost, and Mr. Heap would be grateful for any news about his son, who's just 19 years old. But they never did find any news. They never did get any closure, because like Allibone, he's one of those missing, killed no doubt, at Gullymont in August 1916. Morris Lee was another one of those men that died that day, and it was said that he was killed just as he and his men reached the German trenches. Captain Grierson from the Northamptonshire Regiment says, "Although he had not been with me very long, I liked him immensely. He was always such a perfect gentleman and did his work well and willingly without making any fuss about it. I can safely say he didn't honour the meaning of the word fear. He was in every way a very gallant officer, and his men were devoted to him." He also is remembered on the Teatvale Memorial. Albert Warren came from Church Street in Moulton, Northampton. He was reported missing in that attack on the 18th of August, and nothing was known about him until one day in 1930, when his body was discovered where he fell at Gullymont. His remains were identified by his personal belongings that were found on his body: his watch, a razor strap, two dentures and a pen. Previously, the local newspaper had reported that Warren, who for some time past has been missing, is now officially reported killed on the 18th. He was a member of the church choir and a bell ringer and was well known as a footballer. He was employed by Mr. Buswell and belonged to the Odd Fellows, in which he was very prominent, and he was much respected and liked in the village. So 14 years after he was killed, after he'd gone missing, Albert's body was finally recovered, and he's buried some way away from where he died. He was taken, like so many others, to the Sayre Road No. 2, the largest cemetery, the largest Commonwealth War Grave cemetery on the Somme, where he's buried. And we know exactly where he died, because the burial return gives us the map reference, which takes us back to Gullymont. Now, what about this tragic story? There was a man called William Moles from Northampton, and when the Great War broke out in 1914, he was 63 years old and obviously too old to fight. But his son did. His son enlisted with the 7th Northants, the battalion we're talking about, in April of 1915. Now, William, the father, was an incredible man. He's not famous or mentioned in any of the history books. He's just an ordinary man with a massive heart and soul. On the 1st of August 1916, here in Northampton, he was on duty conveying wounded soldiers from Castle Station to the various hospitals in the town. Amongst the wounded, he discovered a local man who had been serving with the Canadians, a man called Jack Evans. And after he finished his shift, William went to see Jack's mother and gave her the news that her son was alive and being treated in Duston War Hospital. The local newspaper said about William, "The energy he shows is a final example to others who, with much more spare time, are less concerned in public movements." Now, 2 weeks after this, William's son James was one of those reported missing at Gullymont. He hoped in vain for good news, and it wasn't until months later that they received the news he'd been shot in the chest whilst acting as a stretcher bearer. And this news must have been devastating to William and his wife Eliza, but his work at home continued. After the war ended, the wounded continued to arrive in Northampton. And in May 1919, he delivered a gravely ill soldier to the General Hospital. The following day, William visited and gave him his ration breakfast. He visited him again a few days later, but sadly the young man died. Another soldier noticed William's care and commented, "Actions show a man's true character. They speak louder than words." He died in 1936, and his son James is buried in the Delville Woods Cemetery, close to where he fell. There was a newspaper article about him. It says that the death of Private James Moles the youngest son of Mr. and Mrs. Moles of Adnet Road, was officially reported to them on the 5th of September, has been wounded in action on the 18th of August. Since that time, they've been anxiously waiting for news as to his whereabouts and still making inquiries. He's 31 years of age, and he was previously employed at the Manfield & Sons, and news of his present whereabouts will be thankfully received. Now, I've been to Gullymont many times, as I said at the beginning of the podcast. I've stood in that cemetery, I've looked out across that field and thought of those men that came from my hometown of Northampton, and I wondered what it must have been like for them to attack here on that day, what it was like in 1916, and how they felt as they went into action. And by recording this podcast and by talking about their stories, it means that those men are not forgotten, are they? And by doing this podcast, it gives me a chance to understand this small battlefield, these killing fields of Gullymont in August and September of 1916. And it allows me to pay tribute not just to the men that fell, but in this case, the father of James Moles, who did so much great work, not just before he died, but after he died and even after the war. So what we're going to do now is, first of all, look at the Battle of Gullymont through the eyes of the Germans that were there on the 3rd of September. And a few years ago in the Western Front Association journal Stand 2, a man called Sebastian Lorden used a book that had been published by a man, a German man that was captured that day by the Irish, called Wilhelm Nohr. And he wrote his memoirs in 1926. And it's through his eyes that we're able to tell the story from the German side of the wire. It was on the 23rd of August that he arrived at Gullymont with his men that came from Hamburg in Germany. He said, "We were to man the second and third line at Gullymont. Everything looked fine on the map, just like our previous position at Ransart. If only the trenches were still there. I was asked by my CO to relay a comment on the actual state of the position after having reached it. A couple of days later, I got hold of an aerial photo showing our position at Gullymont, a literal moonscape without any traces of buildings, roads, or even the railway left. By nightfall, we were approaching a village presumed to be Morville. Instead, we found ourselves in Combley. Actually, we'd got lost and were forced to walk in complete darkness across a crater field, northbound towards what was once the Morville to Gullymont road. As if it weren't bad enough, we ran into an artillery barrage, which we hadn't noticed until the gunners suddenly opened up with a deafening fire. Finally, my old compass led us to our objectives. The companies followed right behind. The men were puffing and blowing from the loads they'd picked up at Saley. Provisions, water, hand grenades, picks, shovels, and even timber. During the night, we relieved our Württemberg comrades in arms, who obviously were eager to get away. According to the trench map, Gullymont should have been seen by following the railway cutting for a few hundred yards, but there was nothing except a speck of red dust. Near the railway cutting, narrow trenches had been dug to the left and right, barely able to cover a man standing upright. The men were lying there without any protection against the weather and the shells. We started digging and deepening trenches. At least the third line provided some shelter we could use." He goes on to say that the German men defending Gullymont were grimly determined to fight despite the miserable conditions that they were in. They felt themselves fully equipped. And by this time in 1916, almost every soldier in the front line had got a new steel helmet. And the few who hadn't been able to fetch a steel helmet were quickly offered one of those lying around in abundance on the battlefield. And these are no doubt from the men that had been killed previously. Rifle and machine gun ammunition was given out in sufficient amounts. And the Germans had even managed to get adequate food supplies into the reserve positions, as their field kitchens had dared to get as close as possible. They were provided with iron rations, which consisted of some hardtack, canned meat, and a bottle of mineral water. And they had enough to last 4 days in the trenches. And then, by morning on Sunday the 3rd of September, the Germans could see the British troops pouring out of Trones Wood and heading undisturbed at a leisurely pace for Waterloo Farm. Apparently, the Germans incurred fewer fatal losses due to the bombardment than one might expect. Many men, if they weren't killed immediately, suffered more or less seriously from bleeding wounds or blunt force trauma, and these men had been hit by small shell splinters and some fragments or even lumps of earth. Let's look at an example of that. There was a man called Knave, and he was in command of one of the battalions north of the village. At around 8 o'clock on the morning of the 2nd of September, the officer was severely wounded when he was hit by fragments of a heavy shell in the left leg, and he became buried at the same time. His two companions were killed outright. A party of men hurried out from a shell crater nearby and they unearthed the officer before he suffocated. He was alive, but barely so. His chest and his lungs had been squashed. He was hardly able to breathe. His left leg had been ripped open and was bleeding heavily. And his forward rim of his steel helmet, his lower lip and chin had been split cleanly by a shell splinter. Although he was severely wounded, he had to wait all day sitting upright and barely conscious in a shell hole. His wounds were dressed and he was taken back at night. And I wonder whether he survived. We don't know. The account doesn't tell us. Our correspondent Noel, he tells us that by nightfall on the 2nd of September, morale amongst his unit was fairly good, despite the unbearable conditions. Now what they perhaps or perhaps didn't know at that stage was opposite the German defenders was the British 20th Light Division. And this was one of the Kitchener's new army divisions that had been raised in September of 1914. They had been in France since July 1915 and they'd served up at Ypres, but they still lacked experience of a major battle. And these men from the 20th Division were supported by a brigade of Irishmen from the 16th Irish Division. And it was those Irishmen that were proved to be immortal at Gullimont on that day. Noor was captured in the battle and he described those Irishmen as young folks and due to their seemingly brand new attire could be regarded as just recently committed to the front. The 73rd Fusilier Regiment from Hanover were in the eye of the storm as the British and Irish came over the top. Another German account says that the landscape could be seen swarming with khaki figures. Over to the left, most of the British stood upright in the open ground, shooting into the living wall of our troops, who fought on to the last and were shot down man by man. There was a captain in the Fusiliers' 1st Battalion. They were cut off. And on the report that the enemy were always on top of him, he ordered, "Everyone leave the dugout." The machine gun was then brought up to the exit, but the sentry was killed by a rifle shot. And immediately afterwards, something exploded in the dugout. Everyone screamed, "Get out, get out!" There was a general rush for the exit. Outside of the dugout, there was about 10 British soldiers and an officer was standing there with their weapons aimed at the Germans. And they took them prisoner one by one as they reached the exit of the dugout. They were half unconscious from the gas that had been thrown in. The German account says, "I cannot say anything more since I passed out when I reached the exit and I came to only when a British soldier was ripping my torch and compass from my breast pocket." Going back to Major Niles' battalion, he calculated that his unit's casualties were 450 men killed and wounded and about 150 to 200 men captured. And that's about 90% of his battalion's combat strength. And he rightly concluded his battalion had actually ceased to exist on the 3rd of September. He also claims that he read in an English newspaper whilst in captivity that read, "We were witness to a moving scene. A senior German officer lay heavily wounded on a stretcher. The prisoners, before leaving, approached and shook hands. Several were weeping." Now, it wasn't just the 20th Light Division that were there that day. The 5th Division also attacked south of Gullimont, and both divisions' 0 hour was 12 noon. Now, we already know that the German defences had been smashed to pieces, but beneath the rubble, a number of deep dugouts had withstood the shelling. And still deeper, there was a number of tunnels which connected the village wells and had been constructed by the German troops as they'd been here for the previous 2 years. These tunnels were still viable and it provided the opportunity to German soldiers to move around safely more than 10 metres beneath the surface. One of those men that went into action that day was an Irishman, Private Thomas Hughes of the 6th Connaught Rangers. He came from County Monaghan. And he was awarded the Victoria Cross for his efforts. His own account says, "On the 3rd of September, we went over the top. After being hit in 4 different places, I noticed a machine gun firing in German lines. So I rushed up, shot both the chaps on the gun and brought it back. I remember no more till I found myself down in the dressing station. P.S. I forgot to mention I brought 4 German prisoners with the gun." We got another Irishman that was awarded the Victoria Cross for his efforts that day. John Vincent Holland, a lieutenant in the 3rd Battalion of the Leinster Regiment. And it says, "For most conspicuous bravery during a heavy engagement when, not content with bombing the hostile dugouts within the objective, he fearlessly led his bombers through our own artillery barrage and cleared a great part of the village in front. He started out with 26 bombers and he finished up with only 5 after capturing some 50 prisoners. By this very gallant action, he undoubtedly broke the spirit of the enemy and thus saved us many casualties when the battalion made a further advance. He was far from well at the time and later had to go to hospital. And incredibly, we've got a third Victoria Cross that was awarded on the same day, and this one was a man from Liverpool serving with the 12th Kings, a man called Sergeant David Jones. And we've got a newspaper report that tells us exactly what he did that day. It said Sergeant Jones was the right man in the right place at the right moment. We walked right into the hell by the back door and suffered terribly. All our officers bowed out. The men were like sheep without a shepherd. Things were all in a muddle. Nobody seemed to know what to do. Sergeant Jones sprang forward and gave orders. The men quickly recovered, and under his directions they resumed the rush on the enemy's position. The machine guns played hell with us, but the sergeant led us straight to the goal. We carried the position with a rush, though we were greatly outnumbered. The enemy fled in panic, and we lost no time in making ourselves at home in the position. All night long the enemy deluged us with shell fire, and twice they attacked with great fury. They were determined to overwhelm us by sheer weight of numbers, but under the orders of Sergeant Jones, we put our backs into it and drove off the Huns each time. We had neither food nor water, and the circumstances were about as depressing as they could be. But Jones never despaired. He was so cheerful himself that everybody felt ashamed to be anything else. So we held on like grim death for 2 days. We smashed the enemy up every time they tried to overwhelm us. It was very hard fighting indeed, but the boys stuck it well until relief came. We'd been given up for lost. Nobody expected to see us again. That we had come through the ordeal safe and with honour was due entirely to Sergeant Jones's handling of the men, and no one will begrudge him the honour he has won. Jones, unfortunately, was killed just a month later on the 7th of October 1916. He'd only just got married to a lady called Elizabeth, and she placed a number of appeals in the local newspaper press asking for details of her husband. One officer wrote back to her. He said, "I knew your husband. He was a great friend of mine. Please accept my deepest sympathy for yourself and your irreparable loss of a brave and upright man as one could wish for." Harold Redhead was serving with the 20th Kings Liverpool, and he describes in his own words what he experienced at Gullimont.
Some troops took over where we were, and then we had another do coming off at Gullimont. That was a dreadful do there. And we got to the line a bit early, so we had to wait until it got a bit darker. And our officer, a chap called Boundy, he was a Chilean, I believe. Anyhow, while he was talking, he was sending some shells very close, gas shells. And some of us got a nasty whiff of this stuff. It made you sick. And I was told that your throat closed up if you got a lot of it. But when we came to go, I fell down about 3 times, and some others did the same thing. And when we went to take a position in the line, they sent myself and 3 or 4 others to a dugout at the back and told us we weren't going over to stop there. And while we were there, we had an 18-pounder on the top, and every time it went off, we got a cloud of soil on our heads. And after a time, one of our chaps came in badly shell-shocked in no man's land, and he told us that Boundy had been mortally wounded. So we helped him to a shell hole, and Boundy didn't want him to go. He said, "Stop with me until I die," or something like that. So he did. He stopped with Boundy, and another chap joined them, a chap called Green. And while he was there, a German put his head over the side of the thing and threw a bomb at them. It went off, and yet it didn't injure any of them. No. So after Boundy died, Green pushed off. I don't know where he went. But Jones went towards the German lines, and on the way, he passed a slip trench with Germans in no man's land, which apparently we never knew of. And these Germans had a machine gun, were firing on the backs of our chaps. And we said to him, "Well, why the dickens didn't you throw a couple of bombs? You should have done it, your duty." But he was so scared, he went off and he met a Frenchman. and they couldn't understand him, and in the end he came back and joined us, and he was very badly shocked, and every time this gun above went off he gave a scream. Anyhow, when dawn broke, some NCO there asked me to go to the end of the trench near the road and look out for our battalion in case when they came out. He reckoned that they would be relieved or something like that. So I went to the end of the trench, and later on in the morning, the remnants of our lot came out. They were very badly hit. They lost a lot of men. They had a long way to go between our lines and the German lines, several hundred yards. And I heard that we attacked because we expected him to attack a day or two later, and they wanted to prevent that because we weren't strong enough. So anyhow, that's what happened. Anyhow, we were very badly cut up.
Another account of the actual capture of the village was published in the Times. It says of the prisoners, German prisoners, some forced into the open by sulphur bombs were weeping. 6 out of 43 occupants of a dugout sobbed as they crawled into the presence of a bombing party and begged for quarter. An officer with spectacles and elderly went on his knees before a British sergeant. Many Germans offered watches and trinkets in the hope of saving their lives, but it was explained to them that British soldiers were not thieves. So now what I'm going to do is quote from the book by the journalist Philip Gibbs. He wrote a book, The Battles of the Somme, which has been reprinted in recent years, and he was a witness to what happened at Guillemont. He says our bombardment before the attack on Guillemont was more effective. There were not many Germans here, or in the sunken road, or high up in the trenches by Ginchy, who had miraculous escapes. They were killed in masses. A great number of dead were found by our men outside Guillemont in the sunken road, which was the German third line of defence there. They were a frightful sight, as many of them were quite naked, all their clothes having been stripped off by the blasting force of high explosives. Some men, untouched by fragments of shell, were killed by the enormous concussion of air by heart shock, and there was one dead man kneeling and still grasping his rifle with fixed bayonet. The successful attack on Guillemont was due to the effect of our shell fire on the garrison. When the infantry advanced, they met with but little hostile machine gun fire. Most of the Germans were dazed and done. They had no alertness left in them to bring up their weapons and resist the attack. Even many of the dugouts were blown in. A sergeant of one of the companies who came up in support told me today that when he went into a deep dugout, there were 40 men lying. Only 3 of them were alive, and one of those 2 were badly wounded. In other dugouts, they found many dead. In that sunken road, the men were digging themselves in as to get cover from the heavy barrage flung upon it by the German artillery after the capture of the position. A lance corporal was killed here by the side of my sergeant friend, who had buried him where he fell, and another shell killed 6 men in a heap, just as these troops were relieved and went back for a little while into the support lines. They too were buried by another lance corporal who volunteered to go back for the purpose and went under heavy shell fire to do the last service for his good comrades. Lord, how many stories of this kind I have told. The spirit of our men in these hideous places and in these frightful hours is always the same, indomitable and unbroken by the worst ordeals. Gibbs then goes on to talk about the Irish that we said earlier had been attached to the 20th Division. He said the first mention that the Irish troops were fighting at Guillemont has been made officially, and it is now possible for me to write about them in more detail. Their charge through Guillemont last Sunday, with English battalions of riflemen on their right, was one of the most astonishing feats in the war. They went forward with their pipes playing them on in a wild and irresistible assault. If there had been 3 times the number of enemy against them, they would not have been checked until they had carried the northern part of the ruined waste that was once a village. The English troops who fought with them tell me that they had never seen anything like the way in which these Irishmen dashed ahead. It was like a human avalanche, said one of them. The officers cheered their men on as they came alongside. One of their commanding officers, following the last across, picked up pieces of chalk and threw them after his men, shouting good luck to them. They stormed the 1st, 2nd and 3rd German lines through the upper part of the village, sweeping all resistance away and not stopping to take breath. Death has no terror for them, nor all the dead men who lay in their way, after months of dull and dogged fighting in the trenches, where they were restless in their ditches. They're excited at getting out into the open and meeting the enemy face to face. It was not good to be a German in their way. The only fault with this fighting at Gulliman was the rapidity of pace, which gave them no time to safeguard the ground behind them. But that was a fault due to the splendour of their gallantry, and no harm came from it. The English riflemen who brought on their right had more solidarity in their way of going about their business, but they were so inspired by the sight of the Irish dash and by the sound of the Irish pipes that those who were in support under orders to stand and hold the first German line could hardly be restrained from following on. One English sergeant said, "I nearly blew my teeth out of my head in whistling them back." The whole attack from first to last was a model of efficiency, organisation and courage. All the qualities that go to the making of victory were there, fitting in with each other, balancing each other, making a terrific weapon driven by high spirit. The artillery was in perfect union with the infantry. The most difficult thing in war, the brigadiers and the officers carried out the general plan to the letter. It is impossible to overpraise the men who were wonderful in courage and wonderful in discipline. Gibbs then goes on to say that all of the prisoners, of which there are about 600, were in a pitiful condition. As their artillery fire had prevented them from getting any rations for 3 days, their spirit was broken and they were trembling with fear. He says, in another place, an officer fell down on his knees with his hands in an attitude of prayer and his head bowed, and one man pulled out a photograph of his wife and children, holding that out as his strongest plea for life. Our men had no thought to take their lives. As one of the sergeants said to me, as soon as a man surrenders, it's the end of the fight, and I'm sorry for him. But on the whole, the prisoners were well behaved and very glad to be away from the horror of Gulliment, grateful for being given the chance of life. One sergeant of ours, hit in the hip by a piece of shell, captured 4 men without help and then ordered them to carry him back on a stretcher to the dressing station, where he arrived smoking a cigarette with his prisoners acting as stretcher bearers. Words can convey very little of those scenes in Gulliman. The isolated fights, the storming of dugouts, the searching of prisoners, the crowds of British soldiers moving forward to the new lines behind our terrific curtain fire, the Lewis gunners rushing through with their machine guns to take up positions at advanced points, the supported and consolidating troops coming up behind the assaulting troops, starting to dig as soon as the ground had been gained, the stretcher bearers rummaging around the shell craters for stricken men, the walking wounded making their way back across the rough ground, dazed and sometimes falling, not to rise again. The cheers of men taking the last sunken road to the east of Gulliment, where they consolidated a defensive position for the night, and the wild music of the Irish pipers, the crash of German shells, the high whine of German shrapnel, the long rush of our heavies passing overhead to Lousy Wood, and in the midst of all this, the quiet dead. And Gibbs concludes his account by saying, "So Gulliman was taken and held, not only by great gunfire, but by men inspired with some spirit beyond their ordinary courage. And one day these troops will carry the name upon their colours so that the world may remember." That battlefield at Gulliman must have been horrific after the battle had moved on. The terrain was littered with remains of soldiers that had once contested Gulliment. And there was a padre serving with the 16th Division, the Irishman. He recorded what he saw after the battle. He said, "The first part of our journey lay through a narrow trench, the floor of which consisted of deep, thick mud, and the bodies of dead men trodden underfoot. It was horrible beyond description. There was no help for it. And on the half-rotten corpses of our own brave men, we marched in silence, everybody busy with his own thoughts. Half an hour of this brought us out on the open into the middle of the battlefields of some days previous. The wounded, at least I hope so, had all been removed, but the dead lay there stiff and dark, with open, staring eyes, just as they had fallen. Good God, such a sight. I tried to prepare myself for this, but all I'd read or pictured gave me little idea of the reality." Now, as you know, if you've listened to previous episodes of this podcast, I'm always amazed by the number of coincidences that occurs when we're travelling on the battlefields. And it seems to happen more than often on the Somme. I don't know why that is. There's something special about these Somme battlefields. And during a recent visit, I had what was probably the most incredible coincidence that I've experienced. And it was all to do with this battlefield at Gouloumont. I was guiding some people over to the battlefields, and within the party was a keen supporter of the Aston Villa Football Club. And I was aware that Villa had two soldiers were at Gouloumont. One of them was a man called William Gerrish. He played 49 times in the Southern League for Bristol Rovers and scored 11 goals. And after 4 years, he moved to Aston Villa, where he'd scored 18 goals in 59 matches and actually won a Football League Championship medal. And then in 1912, he signed for Preston North End, and there he moved to Chesterfield, but he broke a leg on his debut for the club. And he was with the Footballers Battalion, the 17th Middlesex, on the 8th of August, so a month before the final attack. And it's said that as they made an attack just north of Gouloumont, the Aston Villa player, his legs had been shattered when a shell exploded nearby, laying quietly smoking a cigarette until picked up by stretcher bearers. He died soon afterwards, and his commanding officer, Major Frank Buckley, would later describe him as a most splendid soldier, most willing and brave. Gerrish was indeed a very brave man, because in February 1915 he was in hospital for a slight operation when he heard that a patient in a nearby bed was sinking through loss of blood. Gerrish offered to have some of his own blood pumped into the patient, who was forever grateful for the extension of his own life by about a year. So I told that story close to the place where Gerrish had been mortally wounded, and he has no known grave. He's one of those men that's remembered on the Teat Vale Memorial, and that was our next stop. We went to the Teat Vale Memorial, and I was looking for Gerrish's name on the memorial when behind me I heard a voice that was unfamiliar to me say, "Gerrish, he's up there." And I then realised that the voice was not a voice that I knew. So I turned round, and there was indeed a stranger standing there, and he'd also been looking for the same soldier. Now, that wasn't immediately a surprise to me, because Gerrish is quite a well-known character. It was probably an Aston Villa fan themselves, or maybe just a football fan, looking, as we were, for the name of this man that had died in August of 1916. But what happened next will stay with me forever, because it wasn't a supporter of Aston Villa, and this man knew nothing about Gerrish's career as a footballer. He was actually a relative of Gerrish, a man that was on a motorbike tour, and they were just passing through the Somme, and they decided to stop and look at the Teat Vale Memorial and look for this distant relative's name. And he was as amazed as I was when I told him the story of Gerrish and how he was a famous footballer and how his legs had been shattered by that shell. We couldn't believe it. We really couldn't believe it. How can that happen? An amazing coincidence, one of the many, many coincidences that happen as we walk and as we travel through the battlefields of the Somme. So what can we see now when we travel to Gouloumont? Well, the first place to go to is the Gouloumont Road Cemetery. This cemetery was begun by fighting units, mainly of the Guards Division and Field Ambulances, after the battle itself, but was closed as early as March 1917 when the Germans withdrew from the area. And at that stage, there were just 121 burials. It was greatly increased after the armistice, when the battlefields were searched and many of the burials were brought in from isolated graves and smaller cemeteries that surrounded the village. There's now 2,263 Commonwealth burials and commemorations, and an amazing 1,523 of those burials are unidentified. And amongst those, we know that there are 75 soldiers that died on the 3rd of September 1916. They have been found and identified, but no doubt there are many more within those 1,500 or so unidentified that also relate to that awful day, the 3rd of September 1916. During this podcast, I originally thought I was going to talk about some of those burials in the cemetery, but there's not time, to be honest, and I think to do it justice, we're going to have a whole podcast at some stage on some of those well-known characters and less well-known characters buried in that cemetery. If you then come out of the cemetery, turn left on the main road that goes towards Gullymont itself, and then take a track on your left-hand side, it takes you down to a special private memorial to Second Lieutenant Marsden Smedley. And he was killed on this spot close to the station on the 18th of August 1916. And his details we talk about in a previous episode of Tales from the Battlefield. If you then go into the actual main street of Gullymont and find the church, outside the church is the memorial to the 16th Irish Division that we've talked about in this podcast. And on this cross, it says 1914 to 1918, in commemoration of the victories of Gullymont and Ginchy, September the 3rd, and in memory of those who fell therein, and of all the Irishmen who gave their lives in the Great War, R.I.P. This granite cross was consecrated in 1926, and on that day the villagers of the rebuilt village hung out a banner saying, Viva Ireland. Marshal Joseph Joffre, the commander-in-chief of the French army, was present, and the Bishop of Amiens was also there, and he told his Irish guests that Ireland and France were now sisters in sorrow. And then if you stand with the church behind you, cross the road and head uphill, in the field on the right there's entrances to German dugouts. They've been sealed, so obviously you can't go in them, but they lead down to dugouts which are still there. And if you look at documentaries online, you'll see that they're still accessible in certain situations, but not open to the general public. And then on the D20 that leads east out of Gullymont, you'll find an unusual, in my view, memorial to the 20th Light Division. It's simply a brass laurel wreath and a plaque with the words in memoriam 20th Light Division, set just above the ground level. And the memorial is on the line which formed the objective for the division when they attacked on the 3rd of September. And from that site, you've got a fantastic view across so much of the Somme battlefield. This is not the original memorial. The original was a stone obelisk, which was unveiled in 1922. This is quite a modern replacement memorial. It was unveiled in April of 1995. Of the quarry, well, that's still there. It's fenced off. There's not much to see there. There's nothing, no signs of the railway station that was once there. Some of the sleepers you can still see have been used by local farmers. That's the only sign that there was a railway once there. But there's those memories, those spirits of the soldiers, both British and German, that fought at Gullymont in 1916. There's the spirits of those men from my hometown of Northampton. But we're going to finish with the words of one of those men that fought at Gullymont, and he wrote down his thoughts about what he experienced at Gullymont. He said, "For I cannot too often repeat, a battle was no longer an episode that spent itself in blood and fire. It was a condition of things that dug itself in remorselessly week after week and even month after month. What was a man's life in this wilderness whose vapour was laden with the stench of thousands upon thousands of decaying bodies? Death lay in ambush for each one in every shell hole, merciless and making one merciless in turn. Chivalry here took a final farewell. It had to yield to the heightened intensity of war, just as all fine and personal feeling has to yield when machinery gets the upper hand. The Europe of today appeared here for the first time on the field of battle." And for that account and many other accounts, I've used a tremendous source, Michael Stedman. He simply calls his book Gullymont, and it's published by Pen and Sword in the Battleground Europe series. So that's it for this week. More to come next week, of course. Be very grateful if you continue to rate this podcast wherever you get it from, on Apple, Spotify or Amazon Music. It really does help get the word out to other people. And as usual, we're going to play the last post in memory of all of those men whose lives ended or lives were changed forever at Gullymont in August and September of 1916 by playing the last post.